So, as you probably all know by looking at that newspaper thing that's out there, there was a contest for the list of the 10 top questions in physics, as it was called, at the Strings 2000 conference that was held in Michigan in July. And I summarized the winners in that contest at the end of the conference. And I thought it would be fun to discuss those questions and give some background on them here at the Blackboard Lunch, and to start perhaps a tradition of doing this in various fields in physics, even though the title of the talk is The 10 Top Questions in Fundamental Physics. Of course, you have to insert the word string in there. There are, of course, important fundamental questions in many other areas of physics. Condensed matter physics, astrophysics, biophysics, and so on. And what I'm trying to do partly is to stimulate similar efforts on part of people in other areas of physics. And in fact, in 2 weeks from today, Steve Girvan and Steve Kibbleson, neither of whom are here, have volunteered to present the 10 top questions in condensed matter physics, which should be interesting. And maybe we can get an astrophysicist after that to try to come up with the 10 top questions in astrophysics. It's of course part of the millennium madness. When the century or millennium changes, everybody thinks of this kind of effort. There's the famous example of David Hilbert, who at the turn of the last century posed, 23 or something, the order of 25-ish questions in mathematics that some of which have survived unanswered to today and have certainly had some impact on the development of mathematics, framing the issues for almost a whole century. It's probably easier to do this in mathematics than in any other field, but it's quite amusing to try to do it in any area. It's easier, perhaps, to do it in the area that we're calling here fundamental physics, which is what people doing elementary particle physics, string theory are doing, namely an attempt to understand the basic fundamental laws of the universe, than it is in areas which are like condensed matter physics, and I really look forward to the discussion in 2 weeks from now. It's even harder to do it, and perhaps impossible, in technological areas. So let me just describe to you a bit about the idea behind this effort that took place at Michigan. The participants in the conference were all asked or encouraged to submit a question, and in the end, there were about 70 questions that were submitted. And although some of us were skeptical in the beginning, it turned out that there were a lot of great questions, and there were a lot more than the 10 that were finally chosen. Mike Duff, who organized the conference, Ed Witten, and I were on the committee that chose the top 10. The rules were that you were supposed to submit a question that was well-formulated and important. By important, one meant that the question had a lasting value, that its solution would really advance the field, but it was not the kind of question that would be answered next year, perhaps, but hopefully had a chance to be answered in the next 100 years. Anyone was allowed to ask a question, including the organizers, and in fact, the two first questions are those of Ed and myself. There's no monetary reward for these questions, unlike the Clay Foundation, which is a foundation that was set up recently to support mathematics and that has made a big splash in offering, setting forward a list of 7 questions. I know they couldn't afford 10. The answers of whoever answers any of these questions will get $1 million. Now, when you pay out money, you have to make sure that the questions are extremely well formulated, and they've made a substantial effort to do that. In this case, since we were offering no money, only glory, questions are not that well formulated, and there's no committee to decide when and if they're answered. Personal questions were excluded. There were some interesting personal questions that were submitted. One of the participants asked, how does one get tenure? Obvious answer is, answer one of these questions. The second question that was asked by a few people, it's actually been answered now, and that was, will Ed Witten stay in California? Well, the answer is no. Okay, so now on with the questions. And since this is informal in the ITP tradition, I'm going to use a blackboard, and I'm going to state the questions and then try to explain to you a bit of the background, you know, why we think these are important and answerable and fundamental questions. And I certainly encourage questions from the audience and discussion. So question number one. Has to do with the, if you want, the calculability of the universe. Are all the measurable dimensionless parameters of that characterize the universe the physical universe calculable in principle are some determine by historical or quantum mechanical accident and uncalculable. Now, this was actually my question, and it was, I tried, in playing this game, I tried to imagine what question I would ask if I was awaked from a coma that I'd fallen into in 100 years from now, and had only one question to ask. And this was sort of it, because obviously the answer to this question and explaining the answer to this question, one would have to explain an incredible lot, probably the answers to all the other questions. Now,
So no as an answer?
Sorry?
Would you take yes or no?
Well, it would be, I would love to know whether the answer was yes or no, but I would then ask for elaboration. So, you know, it's pretty arrogant to imagine that we could answer such a question, but it's quite remarkable that we're at a state where, you know, where we could imagine answering such a question. The kinds of fundamental theories we have today that are well established go much farther than ever before in approaching absolute calculability of all dimensionless measurable parameters in the universe. For example, one of my favorite theories, quantum chromodynamics, is pretty good in this respect. For example, if you were to set the quark masses equal to zero, which is not a bad approximation for light quarks, QCD is characterized by one parameter, just the coupling constant, which is dimensionless. And no scale with no quark masses. And thereby, by the process of dimensional transmutation or the emergence of a mass scale in the theory, this coupling gets traded for a scale, say the mass of the proton, there being no other scale in the theory. And then once, in terms of the mass of the proton, which sets the energy or mass scale of the theory, all dimensionless parameters in QCD are calculable. So this is by far the best example we have of the calculability of fundamental theories. Now, of course, in the real world, this is somewhat imperfect, since there are other interactions, and the quark masses are not equal to zero. And even if there weren't any other interactions and the quark masses were equal to zero, there are other kinds of parameters that previously we would not have even dreamed of calculating, such as the number of colors, the dimensions of space and time, and so on. However, QCD goes pretty far. Presently, in string theory, we're faced with a theory in which all of these kinds of dimensionless parameters, mass ratios, couplings, even the dimensions of space, number of colors, all seem to be dynamical. They can assume different values and different approximations to the theory, different solutions. They all seem to be dynamical. And indeed, it's because of that, in this framework, that we could imagine in the next century answering such a question. Now, within string theory, it is quite an open question as to whether, even though all the parameters are dynamical, they're all determined by some principle. It could very well be that even though a theory which has dynamical parameters, those parameters are undetermined. You want the potential that describes the world could have multiplicity of vacua, each one with different parameters. And although the parameters are dynamical, you have many possible solutions of the theory. And indeed, string theory suggests that that might be the case, in which case, not all the dimensionless parameters would be calculable. Another possibility is that some of the parameters or some of the parameters that characterize the physical universe are set by initial conditions. Or they're picked out by the quantum mechanical evolution of the universe, and that quantum mechanical evolution could have and might have on one of these other parallel worlds of Everett chosen other values for some of the parameters of the standard model or the dimensions of space or who knows what. So all of these are possibilities. Some people in trying to come to grips with this possibility invokes something called the anthropic principle and say that there still might be predictive value under such circumstances because the universe had better be like ours, otherwise we wouldn't be here, and since we're here, it's like ours, and therefore you can make a prediction. The author of this question rules out any anthropic argument as a valid answer. Anyway, this is an open question. And it could very well be that in a theory like string theory in the next century, will know that this is possible, at least in principle. Doesn't mean you have to calculate all the parameters to answer this question. You just have to say how you would go about doing it. Much as we believe that the critical temperature for the cuprates is calculable in principle from the parameters of the universe that we already know. I think you all believe that, even though, of course, you have no way of calculating it.
Yep. So I'm trying to get some perspective on this. So I can see how you might apply this to a water molecule, a little bit more dubious about a DNA molecule, and then a bacterium or a gerbil, or as Bob Laughlin would say, a lawyer. I mean, how far would you expect the this principle?
Well, you see, this is a supreme reductionist statement, of course. And it presupposes that we all believe that once that to an enormous degree of accuracy, that the Schrödinger equation and the Coulomb interaction and the masses of various nuclei are enough to explain a lawyer. In principle, this in principle is important because from a science, what it really means is that in principle does not mean that I can tell you how to do that in a practical way. However, if you believed, as some do, that if it is not possible that there are phenomena at the level of molecules or lawyers that cannot be derived or are in conflict with the basic laws of physics, that's a profound statement, and it would encourage one to go into the laboratory and start analyzing lawyers to find the extra physical principles or laws that govern their behavior.
David, at our present understanding of QCD, all we know is the number of colors have to be an odd integer greater than one. But can you imagine QCD?
Well, we know from experiment,
we know it's straight. But without appealing to experiment, without appealing to string theory, can you see some possibility of some internal mathematical consistency that forces?
No.
You don't see any hint of
that. No. Even a theory as predictive as QCD clearly is limited. There are certain, within such a theory, which seems to have no limitations, except that it doesn't include everything, has no limitations, unlike quantum electrodynamics, you see, which is also a very successful theory, but has limitations at high energies or arbitrarily short distances. But such a theory clearly has parameters that cannot be predicted within the theory. And so far, that's not known to be the case in string theory. So that's a negative thing. Any case, yes.
Can I just ask, isn't it true that you can only answer the first part of that question? Because in the second part, you would always be stuck, and like somebody says, okay, I think that it should be one of these two minimum, but somebody else might say, well, you just haven't looked deeply enough, and if you look more carefully, then you'll find that there's something which does distinguish.
Well, this, again, this partly relates to the second question, which I'll come to. I mean, you might have scenarios which force you into the second option. So let me come to the second question. Which is, how can quantum gravity help explain the origin of the universe? Now, this is also a pretty far-reaching question. And it's, again, it's the question sort of assumes, to some extent, this is Ed Witten's question, that the answer is that it can, because it asks not can it, but how can it.
But some people would say now, our questions are not well formulated.
Yeah, this
how questions
presumes
are, exactly
the existence of ground refugee.
Well, okay. So yes. So again, I said this question isn't perhaps as well formulated as I would have liked. By quantum gravity, if Ed clearly meant anything that contains quantum gravity, but the point is here that once you consider the quantum mechanics of space and time, then space and time becomes a dynamical object which is to be understood by physics. And it's in that context that in, you know, over the last decades, many people thinking about quantum gravity and or about string theory and quantum cosmology have asked the question as to whether the origin of the universe can be understood. Or is it more like traditional physics, which lays down the laws of nature, but also requires somebody to specify initial conditions? And traditionally in physics, the initial conditions are not things that are dictated by any deep principle. The purpose of physics is to explain what will happen at a later time if you start with some initial conditions. However, if space and time, the space-time manifold itself is dynamical, then it seems not so obvious that the origin, t equals zero, the singularity that one usually finds in extrapolating cosmological history backwards, is not to be investigated by scientific tools. Now, clearly, quantum gravity breaks down if one tries to extrapolate back to the beginning. But again, we have hope that whatever replaces it, and we see already many indications in string theory in simpler situations, that when one approaches singularities that are apparent at a classical or quantum gravity level, in string theory, those singularities are illusory. There are other descriptions that take over as one approaches those singularities and give very regular, predictable behavior. So it could very well be within a theory like string theory or any theory that contains quantum gravity and must address this origin question that the origin is actually understandable. I think that comes back to what you were saying before. You could imagine a negative answer to question number one coming from a theory of the origin of the universe which said that that was a quantum mechanical process that led to many different possible outcomes and therefore didn't allow you to predict the parameters of the physical laws. Okay, so I think this is it's interesting whether if we took a vote on this question. It's very interesting to, I've always found it fascinating to think about the evolution of questions in physics. This question until 20, 30 years ago was metaphysics. And you could not have gotten away with discussing such a question in a serious collection of scientists, but it isn't anymore. And our colleague Jim Hartle was one of the pioneers, and together with Hawking, in addressing this question and making a simple proposal for a initial condition that might have a rationale behind it.
David, do you think that a quantum universe without gravity is mathematically consistent?
I think it's almost tautological. Gravity is the dynamics of space and time. A universe in which
quantize the metric?
A universe in which space and time was not dynamical
right.
would fly in the f- face of the notion that everything seems to be dynamical.
Right. But why are you forced to quantize the metric? Is there a reason?
As I said, you're forced to, I mean, if you believe, in, if you like Einstein over Newton, then you're forced to believe that everything is dynamical.
That's a personal preference, not that.
Right, but one has served us pretty well.
What is the largest scale on which we actually know that there is quantum behavior, like where you have to put in quantum stuff, otherwise you don't get the right answer?
The largest scale? Well, again, this has to do with reductionism. If you really believe that at some scale there is a fundamental change in physics, some people used to subscribe to life. You know, there was some force that only took part when you had brains or something like that. Then who, you know, there are people like Penrose and even Eugene Wigner played around with ideas of changing quantum mechanics at large scales to understand consciousness. You know, I am a strict reductionist. I believe there's no evidence for that, and everything we've learned in physics points the other way. Okay, let's go on. The next questions are by and large a little more down to earth, and had a closer connection with experiment. You notice that the first two questions are not answerable in any way by experiment. I can know of, and I can think of. But the third question is, and it is, what is the lifetime of the proton?
I'm sorry, David. So yes. If you can measure the gravitational wave background in the universe, you don't think that would help with question two?
Oh, everything would help. A lot of things would help. But I don't think it would ever determine the origin.
No, but would that answer his question about quantum mechanics at large scale?
No. What is the lifetime of the proton, and how do we understand it? This, of course, is an experimental and a theoretical question. It could be answered, of course, by detecting proton decay, which has been searched for years and years. But notice that the question assumes that the proton is unstable. Of course, the lifetime could be infinite. But we really expect that the proton is unstable. And let me just remind you why. First, all attempts at constructing unified theories, which our present theoretical framework cries out for, lead to proton decay. And that's why it was searched for. I mean, this is over 25 years old. It's been searched for over 25 years. Because in any attempt to unify theories that goes beyond the standard model, protons decay. But more importantly, there are some direct reasons. We might expect protons to decay just by looking at the universe. Namely, there is a baryon asymmetry in the universe. It seems that there are no anti-galaxies, and there are more baryons than anti-baryons. That's why we're here. And, well, this baryon asymmetry could be one of those initial conditions or things that you can't calculate. But that seems kind of silly, given our great success in calculating other things in cosmology. To understand the baryon asymmetry, given that the laws of nature are invariant under baryons going to anti-baryons and CPT, it is one requires, among the rest, baryon changing processes. NCP violation, which is a fact of nature, as Sacco pointed out years ago. So that if baryons are not conserved, you might explain this number, and in fact there have been many crude attempts to do so. It's not impossible to imagine calculating, understanding the baryon asymmetry. Finally, even in the standard model, without invoking any new forces or theories that we don't yet have fully under our control, baryons decay via instantons. It's a very slow rate and unobservable, but it happens. And partly that's because we have theoretically good reasons to believe that there are no global symmetries in the world. Global symmetries, for many reasons, are things that we do not believe play any fundamental role. And the only reason we might believe in baryon the proton not decaying is that baryon number is conserved, that there's some global symmetry that forces this conserved quantum number. But we now believe that there are no global symmetries, except those that are accidental, sort of. And so that we should be very suspicious of any global conserved quantum number. There are many reasons for that. A theory like string theory, you can prove, with our control, at least with our present control over the theory, that you can't have anything but accidental global symmetries. But even more fundamentally, in any theory that contains quantum gravity, you can't have global symmetries. Because a proton, baryon number is really conserved, proton could fall into a black hole, however you know that you can't tell that after the proton has fallen into the black hole that there's anything there, except that the black hole has become slightly more massive and has gained one unit of charge, which is a local gauge symmetry. But the baryon number has no effect on the black hole, and therefore has been lost. So even if you didn't have unified theories, or you wanted baryon asymmetry to explain the baryon asymmetry, wanted baryon non-conservation to explain the baryon asymmetry, or instantons, you could still have protons decaying by becoming black holes, collapsing to a black hole, presumably a very rare event, and then decaying to, say, Hawking radiation of photons, plus maybe an electron to conserve the spin.
So how about charge conservation? Is that a global symmetry?
Positron. No, charge conservation is a gauge symmetry. And when you have a black hole that has some electric charge, you notice that effect by the long-range electromagnetic field. A baryon number doesn't couple to any long-range field. It's just a global symmetry, and it's lost in this process. So anyway, we certainly expect that the proton is unstable. It would be a major theoretical surprise.
Is it a global symmetry?
It's a discrete symmetry.
Yeah.
That's a different global continuous. But what is its lifetime? We know that it's something less than 10 to the 33 years. Is that right? Four now. But we don't know what it is. And what it is, given this scale, this of lifetime, that means that its decay is associated with a very high energy scale. So somehow this lifetime goes like some very big scale over the mass of the proton to maybe the fourth power in usual theories. And this unification, or maybe the Planck scale or string scale, would determine the lifetime. So learning about the lifetime of the proton and its decay processes would teach us an enormous amount about possible unification, maybe string theory, maybe something else, whatever. So this is a very important question. Unfortunately, the experimental tools we have for dealing with this question are limited, and because of this sensitivity to the scale, it gets harder and harder to proceed. But experiments continue.
Can you remind us what the evidence for it being less than 10 to 15 years is?
Well, you take this big tank of water and you wait, and you look for.
It's taking more than.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, if you want to be a lawyer, that told it the life limit was mode dependent.
Yeah, it's mode dependent. It's mode dependent, and it's conceivable that there are special modes where it would be more visible, but you know, those possibilities are narrowing as well with super Kamiokande. Okay, the fourth question, which again, relates to ongoing experimental program, is nature supersymmetric? And if so, how is supersymmetry broken? Now, this is, of course, a theoretical and an experimental problem, and will probably be answered, many of us believe, in the next few years by experimental physics. In fact, the search for supersymmetry is the one of the main goals of the next generation of experiments in particle physics. The justification for the machines that are now being built or being proposed, the exploration of this possibility and of the myriad of phenomena that will open up once one starts discovering superpartners. It's kind of amazing for those who are not particle physicists, to look at this scenario, because there is this purported symmetry, supersymmetry, which is a fermionic extension of ordinary space-time symmetries, where you rotate coordinates or boost them not just in the ordinary space-time dimensions, but in some extra quantum anti-commuting dimensions. This is a very profound, beautiful symmetry. Attracted an enormous amount of attention just because of its elegance. But it is very powerful symmetry. And it predicts twice as many particles as we've ever observed. So we've seen half of the supersymmetry multiplets. But for every fermion we've seen, we haven't seen the corresponding boson and vice versa. And so you might ask, why do people believe that there's any chance for this symmetry where so far there's been no direct evidence? And why is that becoming the main goals of experimental particle physics? It does, I must admit, mean that in particle physics, more so than any other field of physics, experimentalists have learned to trust theorists to some extent. Whether they're right or wrong in doing so, it's the case. Theorists like supersymmetry because it's beautiful, but also because it is the best explanation given so far of the hierarchy. The hierarchy is another question that I'll come to in a moment. It's this great disparity of scales between the Planck scale, which perhaps is the fundamental scale of physics, where gravity becomes strong, and the scale of elementary particle physics, a disparity of 19 orders of magnitude. And supersymmetry gives an extension of standard physics that seems to naturally explain this hierarchy, and there's other appealing phenomenological factors. It also seems to explain, there's one bit of experimental evidence for supersymmetry. Now, in, you know, it's hard to pin hundreds of million dollars of searches on one bit of experimental evidence, but it's also pretty hard to get experimental evidence about physics at 10 to the 18 to the 19 GeV. You all know that people have been extrapolating the coupling constants of nature as a function of energy. As you know, they vary with energy because of screening or anti-screening, asymptotic freedom or infrared slavery. And the strong forces get weak at high energies. The electroweak forces get weak and weaker and stronger, and they seem to converge somewhere close to the Planck energy. And over the last 20 years or so, there have been extremely precise measurements of the parameters of the fundamental model so that one can track this evolution, theoretically, out to very large energies by 19 orders of magnitude and still predict these extrapolated values to less than a percent. And at the beginning, the error bars were like this, and the fact that they seemed to come together was very nice and was a stimulus for unification. But by now, the error bars are really teeny, and one can see that just using the standard model, these forces don't really meet at a point. They sort of come like this. Now, three lines don't have to cross at a point. And by now, the error bars are so good that you can say that the forces of the standard model are not unified, unless there's something else. And the simplest thing you can do is take the standard model as it is and make it supersymmetric, and say that, well, it becomes supersymmetric at a scale which is of order of TeV. You don't have to be too precise. This is where we now are stopping to do experiments. And if you do that, then these points, these three lines, extrapolated 19 orders of magnitude, if you have the precision to do so, now meet at a point. And that point is only one order of magnitude less than the Planck mass, very close to where gravity becomes important. Now, that is not, you know, a discovery of supersymmetry or anything like that. But it's certainly nice and encouraging.
How sensitive is that to your choice of a TeV as the system?
It's very insensitive. It is sensitive if you make it 10 to the 5 TeV. If you make it 1 TeV or 2 TeV. So that is the one bit of evidence. In fact, the one bit of evidence we have for where unification takes place, which for string theorists is very nice because it's close to where we believe it takes place, which has to do with gravity. So supersymmetry has that one bit of evidence. It can explain the hierarchy. It's beautiful. And of course, from the point of view of string theory, it's essential. As a symmetry, a fundamental symmetry of nature. However, none of these tell us too much about how it's broken. And it's obviously broken in the real world since we don't see the superpartners. Except that it's broken at low energies if we're going to explain the hierarchy and if we're going to explain this extrapolation. And so experiment here is going to play an absolutely fundamental role in either telling us that this path is correct or false, and picking out one of the many possible patterns of supersymmetry breaking and guiding any unified theory, certainly string theory, into how to relate its fundamental symmetric phase, which might be easy to understand, to the broken phase that we observe at low energies. Yeah.
I'm going to a fair number of talks at the ITC program, and I just something is striking me as somewhat vaguely similar. many people in that program have some very elegant and beautiful theoretical ideas, which may have some connection to what's actually going on in ITC. And there's no doubt that at least some of them are internally consistent and aesthetically very appealing. The question which gets asked, which I think is certainly the right one for us in that program, is what experiment could be done which would convince you to abandon this elegant and beautiful theoretical
I understand the question. Absolutely. Right. Well, his question is a very good one. What experiment would convince you that supersymmetry is not a symmetry of nature? It's always harder to exclude something than to find something. The real answer is there are two aspects of supersymmetry. One is going to be almost supersymmetry as a whole. You see, in string theory, supersymmetry, for example, is crucial to the structure of the theory at its characteristic scale, which is the Planck scale. Well, we're not going to measure that directly. So we're really talking about low-energy supersymmetry, which we believe for separate reasons, having to do with this hierarchy and this extrapolation. If low-energy supersymmetry will be ruled out by LHC, if it's not seen there. There's no question about that. Mm-hmm. There's no question about, you see, supersymmetry is an incredibly predictive symmetry. This is, you postulate a symmetry, it's much easier to rule it out than it is to rule out a vague theory. A symmetry immediately says that, you have every particle has a sparticle. Now, there's some breaking, which causes a splitting of those levels, which we don't know how to calculate. But what is true is that these particles, the photino, which is the spin 1/2 partner of the photon, couples to ordinary matter with exactly the same coupling as the photon. So once you know the mass scale, which is essentially saying a TeV, or what we call low energy, then you can immediately predict lots of things about hundreds of particles. So there's no question that when you have the energy, which is LHC, or the SSC would have had even better, but LHC does, you can rule this out if you don't find it.
Sorry, why is that the energy and not, say, 10 dB or 50 dB?
We can't yet say. We know it's not I'm sorry. Because of what I said here, in order to explain this hierarchy, if you would like to use supersymmetry to explain the hierarchy, this disparity of scales, and if you want to explain this unification, then you need supersymmetry at around a TeV. The mass scale of the supersymmetric partners has to be around a TeV. LHC will have no problem. And I think that anyone you talk to in this particle theory will say that if LHC does not see superpartners, low-energy supersymmetry is ruled out. You can, of course, then say, okay, supersymmetry is a symmetry that's broken at the Planck scale. Mm-hmm. Then it doesn't help you with any of this, and most likely it means that there's new physics that you haven't thought of that comes in. Okay, something has to come in. And that you'd also probably mean that there's some new physics. Now, of course, you could never, by this low energy argument, rule it out at some high scale, but you can easily rule out low energy supersymmetry if you have enough energy.
See, Jeff? There's also the issue of protecting the Higgs mass gradient directions. I was just wondering.
Yeah, that has to do with, that's how you explain the hierarchy.
Saying that
10 GeV.
10 GeV, excuse me.
then it runs into problems. I mean, that takes analysis, and you can fiddle here and there, but the LHC has enough scope to cover the range completely. Tony?
David, I'd like to ask you a question that I know you cannot answer, but I'd like to have your opinion. I really am interested
the
in your
answer
opinion.
Is maybe.
I want to know your opinion. How do you know that there, well, after all, 40 years ago, nobody heard of supersymmetry. And how do you know that there's not some other symmetry that nobody has thought of that may be really crucial?
Obviously, again, now there are many reasons why.
I like your opinion.
Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, there was.
I certainly it's try even, to invent right. new symmetries and fail, right? Many people try very hard.
Okay. Eventually, you knew a new symmetry. You can always add symmetries of the kind we.
Right.
Before supersymmetry was discovered, there was a no-go theorem based on very fundamental principles of nature that said beyond the symmetries we know, things like isospin and Lorentz invariance, there can be nothing new. Coleman and Mandula, Sidney Coleman, very smart guy. Supersymmetry totally contradicted that no-go theorem. The people who made that no-go theorem made a little assumption. They assume that if you have a symmetry, they're generators, you know, charges, and those charges are commuting charges. Because nobody'd ever heard of a supergroup or a superalgebra in that context. And so this little technical assumption they meant that they'd prove that there could be nothing new under the sun. And then supersymmetry came along, and there was something new under the sun. Well, now we have a refined no-go theorem, which includes even the possibility of anti-commuting charges. And it says that there's nothing new under the sun. And it could be wrong again. But it's a powerful theorem. So, I don't know. Okay, let me go on because this room is needed at 1:30. So the fifth question was, why are there 3 plus 1 space-time dimensions? Now again, this question is one that would be sort of metaphysical up to a few years ago. Although, you know, people have always speculated in physics what's special about 3 dimensions. And it's sort of interesting to think about planetary motion in other dimensions than 3 and why 3 is good. But in string theory, this is not a metaphysical question. Because in string theory, the dimensions of the universe that we observe that look like the 3 spatial dimensions we know about in time is a dynamical issue. String theory is a theory which is formulated in 10 dimensions, we thought, but then as one of the couplings of the theory was varied semi-classically, it turned out that the theory actually has a hidden dimension which gets bigger as you make this coupling bigger. So maybe it's formulated in 11 dimensions. Maybe more. We don't really know. And furthermore, in any of these formulations, what you see at low energies might be effectively 3 plus 1, 4 plus 1, or 5 plus 1. Some of these dimensions might be compactified into small little manifolds. And in fact, much of trying to connect string theory to the real world, which is, we know, a 3 plus 1 dimensional world, macroscopically, is in understanding this process of compactification. So one aspect of this question is to understand how, within string theory, would be to understand how the theory, however it's formulated, chooses dynamically a world which macroscopically looks like 3 plus 1.
You write 3, 4, 5. Is it fine to write 1, 2, 3?
Right? 1.
No, you say the plus 1, I'm curious about.
Well, I'll come to that in a moment.
Okay.
And these possible dynamical scenarios have recently become a lot richer as people have realized that one can have a situation where there are even non-compact or large extra dimensions that aren't little circles, but that we're trapped on a brain, we're trapped on a surface, as if we live in this room, but or this room is our universe, three-dimensional, but we're trapped on the blackboard and can't get out of it. And only gravitational forces, or gravitons, can escape into the bulk. Such brain scenarios have had been a subject of much speculation and study in the last few years, and again seem to be viable dynamical possibilities for such theories which have extra dimensions. In this case, they're actually large extra dimensions. They're just hard to explore by ordinary tools.
Is there enough gravitons come off the blackboard when they pull us off the blackboard too?
No, we are things that live only on the blackboard, or if you want, are made up of degrees of freedom that only exist on the blackboard. Part of this question also comes back to what you were saying, which is a deep and totally unexplored, and maybe, you know, the most metaphysical of all, which is, why is there only one time? Why is it so hard for us to imagine more than one time? And this question becomes, again, a very critical one, I think, ultimately for string theory, where we really believe, those of us working in the field, that somehow space and time aren't really fundamental. They simply represent coherent manifestations of some other degrees of freedom, which are really the fundamental way of formulating the laws of physics. And on a macroscopic scale, space and time is a good approximation, to describe things as occurring in a space-time background, even a quantum mechanical space-time background. In that context, trying to understand the emergence of space is not so difficult. And we indeed even have mathematical models which are formulated in terms of degrees of freedom with no space at all. And then, yet, if you set up the right dynamical setup, it looks like, or you can find an alternative approximate description in terms of objects moving in space. But nobody has ever been able to think of something in which time wasn't fundamental. And it really staggers the imagination to try to imagine doing physics in a theory in which time is an emergent phenomenon. Tony.
David, I thought that there are a few theories with two times that...
Yes, and they're all sick.
It's not Bars wrote down that are consistent, no?
Well,
Bars can claim
he tries.
He's written many papers.
Sakharov has tried. Lots of people have tried. You either have two circumstances. One, the theories are sick. They contain a causal or non-unitary, not necessarily positive probabilities, or the extra time is a gauge degree of freedom, which you can gauge away, and then you have one time.
I'm sorry, how do you measure dimensionality of space and time? I mean, why do you worry about that? I imagine if I live in a three-dimensional space plus one time, I can tell if a given world is two-dimensional, because I'm... I can measure a dimensionality which is less than mine. How can I?
Well,
why is it important?
Well, it's obviously important for our world. The dimensionality of our world is a fact of life, right? So there are various ways a physicist discover hidden dimensions, if that's what you're asking. So it could very well be that there is at every point in space a circle, which is so small that the only things you see are the zero momentum excitations of particles that live on that circle. Because any particle with a higher momentum excitation, right, would have a momentum which went like some multiple of the inverse radius of that circle. If that radius was very small, the momentum would be enormous, the energy would be enormous. So this radius is the Planck length. To excite higher modes would cost you 10 to the minus 5 grams of energy. So one way of detecting that circle would be to detect these higher modes, called Kalitza-Klein modes. or in fact in experiments that are now being discussed seriously at places like CERN, if you had extra dimensions like this that you can only be accessed gravitationally, two particles meeting with very high energy could lose gravitons into the extra dimension. And these processes are strong enough to actually give us the best bounds on the extra dimensions, the size of these extra dimensions that exist. So there are many ways of detecting extra.
That would look locally like non-conservation of energy.
In this case, it would look locally like non-conservation of energy. In this case, you'd simply see characteristic modes. Namely, you'd be exciting particles that live on a little circle. Okay, anyway, so this is a important question, both practical one for string theory and a very deep one if one would like to understand not just why what picks out three spatial dimensions, but why is the signature of space-time always inconceivably anything other than 1, comma, d? Second, the sixth question, again, is experimental and theoretical. It has to do with a cosmological constant. This, of course, would be one of the 10 top questions in astrophysics. Why is the cosmological constant what it is? Is it zero, which everyone thought until recently? Or is it the value that the astrophysicists now say, which is something like 0.7 times the critical mass needed to close the universe? Is it time dependent, as some people might like to argue that it's show signs of being non-zero, but that's only temporary. Eventually, it'll be zero. And the cosmological constant, you remember, is the expectation value of the energy minimum tensor in the vacuum. It's the vacuum energy. And in any quantum theory, it gets contributions from any zero-point fluctuations of any degree of freedom in that exists. So it would naturally be of order the mass scale of whatever physics you discuss. If you're discussing standard model, you have lots of particles interacting, and they, in the vacuum, have zero-point fluctuations, which would give cosmological constant of order a TV, a GV, whatever. You have gravity, you might expect this scale to be the Planck mass. In which case, this number, zero or this, is off by 120 orders of magnitude. And this has been a problem for fundamental physics forever, or at least since the last 50 years.
It's like a theoretical question. Is there a consensus about the experimental value?
Well, I'm not the best. There seems to be a consensus, but my personal experience with astrophysics is that consensus in astrophysics changes from decade to decade.
I think it's a fair statement to say that omega in total is 1, and that we don't know lambda.
In any case, this seems to be the consensus, but that's been very recently formed, and probably. But whether it's this or this, both are equally fundamental puzzles for fundamental physics, where you would naturally predict something which is bigger by 120 orders of magnitude. And we really know of no principle in nature that explains why it's so small.
Why can't
supersymmetry used to be is a perhaps part of the explanation. If the world was supersymmetric, there'd be a good reason why this number would be zero. So maybe it plays a role. But once it's broken, you lose that reason completely, and the mass scale becomes the mass scale of supersymmetry breaking, which is a TV. And this number corresponds to a mass scale of 10 to the minus 2 electron volts. So it doesn't help you very much.
David, why can't I say that this is experimental evidence that quantum mechanics fails?
I think that would be premature, to say the least. In any case, aside from the fundamental question in cosmology and astrophysics, this is an immensely practical question for string theory. Because when string theory tries to construct from its structure a solution, quantum solution for the world, one of the things it automatically calculates and can't fiddle with is the cosmological constant. And many attempts run into big cosmological constants. And they're not very solid. It's very hard for us to break supersymmetry in string theory, understand that breaking. But one had better find a very small number. So this question is not just an abstract, interesting question for the history of the universe, which is crucial, this understanding of the large-scale structure of the universe, but it's an absolutely practical question for string theory, because this will be the first test of any purported solution of string theory would be, well, what did you get for the cosmological constant? And, that's a very important question. It also would be very important here for us to get more experimental confirmation and a consensus that has a chance of surviving beyond a year or two. Because if this number really is not zero, then it poses a really fundamental challenge for fundamental physics to calculate that number. It's another absolutely basic number. Measures the vacuum energy, and we should be able to calculate them.
Is it possible that these fluctuations contribute to the vacuum energy, but that energy isn't dynamically important for the universe? So, like, it's 10 to the 120, but you don't need to worry about it.
Not according to Einstein's equations. Now, this, you see, by this you really mean the right-hand side of Einstein's equation. So. Yeah. And so whatever enters here changes, affects the structure of the universe. If you not having to worry about it means you take your theory and then you subtract it out, which is what you're allowed to do in any theory that doesn't have gravity as part of your world. But in a theory of quantum gravity, the fluctuations of the vacuum affect the geometry of the vacuum, and you can't subtract them out.
But maybe that's the thing about quantum gravity, that it doesn't notice things. It's the special thing about quantum gravity.
No. Quantum gravity has to be an extension that reduces to classical gravity, and cosmological constant enters and affects the geometry of space-time. Okay. The seventh question in this list was a question more about it's really a totally string theory question. You'll actually notice that none of these questions so far is really totally specific to string theory, but this was a question about M theory. There's something called M theory, and the question was essentially, what is M theory? Because we don't really understand. M-theory, I told you that string theory discovered at one point that it had one extra dimension that it had overlooked. And it really was an 11-dimensional theory. And this is part of the enormous development in the last few years of relations between various string theories that used to be regarded as distinct and are now related by a web of duality. So there are the picture that was invented by Joe Polchinski, which describes sort of the space of solutions of string theory. These are the five string theory forms of string theory that had been discussed until recently. so-called type 2A and B string theories, heterotic string theories, and an open string theory. And although there seem to be some relations between these two and these two heterotic theories, really wasn't understood whether they were separate theories or perhaps one component of a bigger theory. Because all we could do was with this is supposedly a plot of parameter spaces of the theory. You could treat these theories perturbatively around a point in which this point in which you started out with freely moving strings in some smooth background, like Minkowski, 10-dimensional flat space. But then we discovered all sorts of ways of connecting these theories by dualities, by discrete symmetries that the type that take electric to magnetic fields and turn one theory into another theory, and the observables of one theory into an observables of another theory, and weak coupling here into strong coupling here, and allow one to make identifications along this web of theories. And understand that all of these are just reflections of the same theory. And also to discover that as one varied a parameter, the coupling of this type 2A theory, what opened up was a cylinder. It was an extra dimension, so a little radius. And it turned out that that radius was the coupling constant. As one went to strong coupling, the radius opened up and one got an 11-dimensional theory. This 11-dimensional theory is not very well understood, unlike these regions here. In these regions, we have a full quantum mechanical theory that can be studied to all orders in perturbation theory. Feynman graphs to all orders. It's finite. This theory, all we have is the low energy Born approximation theory called 11-dimensional supergravity.
So that theory may even not be a string theory. Could be some.
No, doesn't even look like a string theory. It looks more like a membrane theory, but we don't know how to formulate membrane theories. The strings have opened up and become cylinders. Mm-hmm. So this theory is sometimes called M theory. This 11-dimensional theory, which at low energies is something we can talk about, and which is related through these two relationships to all the other forms of string theory. That's one name that's sometimes given to M theory, this would-be theory in 11 dimensions, which at low energies is described by supergravity. The other name is the whole shebang, the theory, which has all these different manifestations, and which we certainly don't know how to formulate, and which very well might not have any notion of dimension or even space-time associated with it. And one of the great drives, goals of string theory at the moment is to work towards a kind of background, independent, formulation of the theory. And sometimes that's called M-theory. So this question is a little ambiguous, my view, as to what. But it's one of the central questions in string theory. And finally, let's get on to question number 8. That was a question, again, which is important in string theory, but much more general. That was, what is the resolution of the black hole information paradox? Now, you know that what this paradox is. You start with matter, forms a black hole. Black hole radiates, thermal radiation disappears. We've started with some state, out comes thermal radiation, looks like you've lost information. You've thrown in here all sorts of stuff, information. The only thing you know about the black hole is this mass and its charge and its angular momentum. the thermal radiation coming out doesn't seem to have any more information than that. You've lost information. Hawking used to argue that this was governed, therefore, by super quantum mechanical laws of nature. Unitarity of the S matrix, of the time evolution of quantum mechanics, could not be consistent with this picture of black hole thermal radiation from a black hole. Therefore, if you want, at a large scale, the laws of quantum mechanics break down and you lose information. Well, we don't believe that anymore. Particle physicists who got interested in gravity never believed that, most of them. And in fact, we now have evidence that this is not the case. We have evidence partly from the properties of black holes, which, as you know, appear to have entropy associated with them, a temperature and an entropy, the entropy being proportional to the area of the black hole. Now, normally, if we have entropy, it simply means we have degeneracy. We have some number of microscopic states with the same macroscopic parameters. In the case of a black hole, the mass and the charge and the angular momentum. But to count the number of states, you need a quantum mechanical system with the discretization. And we haven't had that till recently. String theory provides us with such a thing. And in string theory, it has turned out to be possible to actually precisely count the number of states of a black hole of a certain type, using the tools of supersymmetry, by the way, very strongly, and to account for this entropy precisely as the log of the number of microscopic states, which is a strong indication that a black hole is nothing weird, but rather just a complicated object like the sun. And that this thermal radiation is only as thermal as the radiation from the sun is, which actually, of course, does not violate quantum mechanics and its evolution. But so far, we've been unable to go through, although there are very strong evidence that one should be able to do that because of these dualities that allow us to translate questions about black holes into questions about well-understood physics like non-abelian gauge theories. So far, we haven't yet been able to do that and to show how this information paradox is resolved satisfactorily. Although I think most string theorists are sure that this is doable. And in my opinion, this is probably the first of these 10 questions that will be answered. But it's not far away at all. And will really clear up, and that's the whole point of string theory, to make quantum gravity useful, clear up one of these very profound and outstanding paradoxes of quantum mechanics plus relativity. Okay. Any questions about that one? So, finally, question number 9 was the I won't write down the question. This is, how do you explain the hierarchy? Now, this is perhaps, in a sense, the most profound question that's asked by traditional particle physics. There is this enormous hierarchy between the Planck scale, which is 10 to the 19 GeV. But which particle physicists, string theorists, are convinced is the scale of physics, that the fundamental dimensionful parameters are set by this scale of energies, Planck's constant and the velocity of light. These are the dimensionful parameters that set the natural scale for physics. But this, of course, is much bigger than 10 to the 3 GeV, or 10 to the 1 G, the mass of the proton, or the mass of the W, or the scale of the Standard Model. And this disparity, which is so crucial for the structure of the universe, cries out for an explanation. Now, I told you that supersymmetry is one of the contenders. Traditional supersymmetry, one of its main arguments for existence is that it could explain this scale. And supersymmetric extensions of the standard model can naturally drive, starting with basic physics up here, produce these mass scale dynamically. That's a very nice feature of it. But there are other non-traditional explanations that have recently been put forward, which are quite dramatic. And they say that one of the reasons for this hierarchy is that the fundamental scale of physics isn't 10 to the 19 GeV. You are mistaken. It's only maybe 10 to the 3 GeV. But gravity doesn't become strong only at 10 to the 19 GeV, but at 10 to the 3 GeV. And this has to do with some of those brain world scenarios I discussed. If that was the explanation, there is no hierarchy. We've just been extrapolating incorrectly. And it's not easy to rule out those speculative ideas. These brain world ideas. Then the effects would be enormously dramatic. At the LHC, you would start seeing not just these extra dimensions in the ways I discussed before, but you'd start seeing strong gravitational effects. You'd be colliding protons on protons at LHC, and they'd form black holes. So this becomes a very, I mean, there are more than one theoretical scenarios with
dramatically different astronomers. No, that's a fiction story where the black hole sinks to the core of the Earth and eats up.
No, black holes don't
do
that.
They're evaporated
when you're
immediately
out. Wouldn't you have difficulties with specific heat of the universe at early stages then?
That's some of the constraints that are put, I mean, the particle theorists who play this kind of game are quite aware of astrophysical constraints. And I don't think it's so much the beginning of the universe, it more has to do with what happens within stars or supernova. So they worry about all the constraints that the standard sources of constraints. In any case, this is clearly one of the fundamental questions in particle physics that I alluded to before. Supersymmetry was one explanation, but it could be there could be other explanations that have been recently speculated on in these brain worlds, which would have absolutely dramatic experimental signatures. And finally, the tenth question is the most remunerative one, because it's more or less the only question that overlaps with the Clay list of 10 questions in mathematics. Two were in mathematical physics. And this was, can we quantitatively understand quark confinement and the mass gap in QCD?
Now, David, the million-dollar prize is only for the mass gap. Is it obvious the two things are related, that if one can prove the mass gap?
Probably. Mass gap is probably simpler.
What do you mean probably?
I said probably.
No, why?
Anyway, let me explain this to the rest of the audience. Okay. So we have the theory of the strong interactions, quantum chromodynamics is clearly correct and well verified experimentally. At high energies or short distances, where because of asymptotic freedom, we can just theoretically calculate anything we want using weak coupling techniques. But the dominant features of the world around us are those of nuclei, bound states of, confined states of quarks, QCD, with a dynamically generated mass. And although we have lots of qualitative understanding of this phenomena and of many of the aspects of nuclei and hadrons based on QCD, our quantitative tools are very poor. The clay question, this was regarded by the mathematicians as a very important question in mathematical physics. Of course, they would like a rigorous proof that one QCD exists and two, it has a mass gap. And for, you know, most of us aren't interested in rigorous proofs. What this question really is asking for is a quantitative understanding, a calculational scheme which doesn't, and by that I do not mean lattice gauge theory, which is a calculational tool but not analytic, one which on a piece of paper one could calculate properties of hadrons with well-controlled approximations. This is not just of, this of course is of great theoretical interest as a matter of principle. It's of great experimental concern because QCD calculations form the basis of the background for all experiments in high energy physics. But also, the techniques that are needed for doing something like this will undoubtedly have an incredibly important effect in many other areas. The techniques for solving, dealing with dynamics of gauge theories intersect even condensed matter physics, not to speak of mathematics, and most importantly, string theory. We have dual relations between string theories and gauge theories. So this is an incredibly important question, and you might even win $1 million if you solve it. Thank you.